Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Just after noon on this Tuesday, Grant and Danny welcoming you back on 106.7 The Fan. A big thanks to Pete Medhurst for getting us up to date. Look, it's a tough day for a lot of reasons in D.C., and we added another one this morning when we found out that one of the true legends and icons of D.C. sports and of the Bullets and Wizards organization, Wes Unseld, had passed away at 74 years old. And when we started thinking about who might make the most sense to have on the show to celebrate his life and career and to educate us on the man that Wes was, one of the first names that came to mind was Phil Chenier, who's kind enough to join us right now to talk about one of his longtime friends, a three-time All-Star, and, of course, Phil Chenier, who we grew up watching broadcast games as a commentator and before that a champion basketball player with Wes here in D.C. Phil, thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate it. I know it's a tough day. If you would, just tell us first when you heard the news and found out today what your first few thoughts were about losing a great pal of yours.
Yeah, thanks for having me. First of all, he, you know, health-wise, he had been struggling for quite some time. And the last time I actually saw him, I think, was sometime in February. Just before the, you know, virus hit and whatnot. And, you know, he's still, I mean, I always remember him because of his stature physically. And I reflect on him because of his stature, you know, in terms of his character. But, you know, he was, he'd lost weight. Obviously lost a lot of the muscle mass and just kind of, you know, saw a guy that was, you know, not the physical structure that you remember. And, so he had been battling, he'd been struggling. He had knee replacements. He had ankle issues. You know, I called him a couple times. His voice was a little weak, but he still would talk. And again, the kindness of the man, he would ask about my kids. He'd talk a little bit about basketball, talk about other things, talk about his grandkids. But you could hear his voice weakening. I got a call over the weekend from Connie, and, you know, she just said that he was in the hospital and, you know, he was in serious condition and it wasn't looking good. You know, they weren't expecting him to, you know, to last long. So got a call this morning and said that he had indeed passed away this morning.
Phil, I'm not quite old enough to have seen Wes play, but my dad just, you know, spun stories about you and Elvin Hayes and he, and just as giant of a man in D.C. basketball as anybody that's ever been. And I, you know, I basically trying to impress my pops as a hoops loving kid would say, I think Dennis Rodman's the best rebounder I ever saw. Right? What about Moses Malone, Dad? Or what about Charles Barkley? And he would just sort of chuckle and shake his head and said, No. Wes Unseld was better than all those guys, just in terms of grabbing boards and using his body and being strong and just a tough guy out on the court. Now, I'd love for you to speak to that.
Yeah. Amazing rebounder. I mean, keep in mind, he had to guard and rebound against guys that had 4, 5, maybe 6 inches on him. Used to have to guard Kareem all the time. But his ability, and he would talk about how he'd have to throw his weight around and get people out of position. He would come and do camps, and he would show people how he could get people off balance by just kind of nudging them at just the right time. And I've told this story before. I first saw him, I was a senior in high school, and he was on the Pan American team, and they came through town and they would play some of the local players. And so I got a chance to see him then. And then, of course, 3 or 4 years later, I'm drafted by the Bullets to come into camp. So, I mean, this was a guy at that point that was still agile. He could move real well, jump. And then, you know, after a couple of knee surgeries and whatnot, didn't have the lift that he used to have, but he still was able to position himself and just had the strongest pair of hands that you can imagine someone having. So if he got two hands on the ball, then you weren't taking it away from him. And I remember him, you know, the ball would be kind of up for grabs, and he'd get two hands on it, just snatching away from whoever else had the ball. And then, of course, he was known for the outlet pass, the quick release that he had, sometimes able to deliver that pass while he was still in the air grabbing the rebound. So I just think of what he brought to this team. First of all, physically, the physical presence that he presented, and then the fact that he was such a great teammate. He was a teammate that was constantly encouraging his team, his teammates, and trying to give them confidence, trying to do what he could do to help them. And I just, you know, and he was just a tremendous person to play with. But you're right, rebounding, that was his forte. And I think there was a game that I was playing in that he got 30 rebounds one time. And again, just, you know, he would have this, he would go to this place mentally where every loose rim he felt was his, and he was grabbing it. And then, of course, when, you know, a year after my first year, when Eldon came, you had two of the top rebounders in the game. You know, that's why we were able to go with that small lineup with Mike Reardon basically playing the forward, and we let the two of them do all the rebounding, and we'd get out and run.
He averaged 16 or more rebounds, just looking it up now. Each of his first 5 seasons, of course, his first year joining the league, he was the MVP, he averaged 18 boards, talking about the career of Wes Unseld with Phil Chenier. So when you show up, you're drafted fourth overall in 71. He had already played 3 seasons. Your rookie year, if my math is right, would have been his fourth year. What do you remember initially? It sounds like, just based on the story you just told us, you already knew of him a little bit, but presumably you didn't have much of a relationship. What was that night like initially, and was it as if you were walking into the locker room and he was, you know, a star that you'd look up to, or was he just another guy?
No, he was, you know, he was a star that I looked up to. In fact, they had a team full of stars, so it was a veteran team. They had just come off going to the finals against the Milwaukee Bucks that year, and so I watched the games, you know, the finals, and the series against the Knicks, the conference finals, too. So, yeah, Earl Monroe, Freddie Carter, Kevin Lockery, Jack Merritt, Wes, Gus, Earl, you know, I've seen all those guys, John Trezvan. So I come into the locker room. We're out at Fort Meade because that's where we were having training camp. And training camp had already been established for – it already started 3 weeks ago. I came late because it was a supplemental draft, and everything was starting late for me. So, I come in. I'm seeing Earl on one side. I see Freddie Carter. You know, I see Gus over here. And, you know, and you see Wes. And like I said, you know, at that point he still was – I mean, he was 250 pounds, but he was, you know, all muscle. He was able to get up and down the floor. He was running, jumping, dunking. And you know, it was, you know, it was one of those things. And here I am, 6'3", 6'4", 180 pounds, and these are all grown men. So, you know, I had to wonder if I belong. But, you know, not only Wes, but Gus, John Trezvan, Earl, all those guys, you know, kind of adopted me and brought me in and, you know, made me feel comfortable. And I guess that's the other side of West that I want to, you know, let people know about. I mean, behind that scowl that he would have, that he was a gentle giant, and he was kind, he was compassionate, he was certainly supportive and protective of his teammates. You know, I remember him on a number of occasions for both me and Kevin Porter, mostly for Kevin Porter, because Kevin would always get in the little scraps here and there, and Wes would be the first one to step in and make sure that, you know, nobody messed with Kevin. So, you know, that's kind of the description and the thinking and the image that I will always have of Wes Unseld.
So, and the great Phil Chenier is with us here on Grant and Danny. My first memories of Wes were as a coach for the Bullets, and he coached some of my favorite players of all time, you know, where there was Bernard King or Moses Malone, Muggsy Bogues, and some of the others where I kind of, again, fell in love with basketball. But I feel like I didn't know that much about the man, right? Kind of he was pretty private when it came to public stuff and interviews and things like that. So
yeah.
While he was a giant and so influential for so many people at the same time, give us some insight. You touched on a little bit, Phil, but sort of behind the scenes, both as a teammate, as an executive, in the community. I feel like we know so little, and a lot of us that even grew up when he was a major fixture.
You know, he was one that would always defer attention. He never tried to, even as a player. I mean, you know, he was one of two players all time that was MVP and Rookie of the Year. He and Wilt were the only two players ever to get that distinction. So, I mean, obviously, and eventually became one of the 50 greatest. But just as humble, and never tried to draw attention to himself. So even as a coach, you know, same thing. And, you know, great players, I've said this over and over again, that great players sometimes have a hard time relating to other people that don't have the greatness that they have. And when I say relating, I mean, you know, he had this drive in him. Like, if he had made up his mind he was going to get the rebound, there was no stopping him getting the rebound. Now, he may get called for a foul, but he wasn't going to stop from getting that rebound. And I think there were some times when he didn't seem the same kind of drive, the same kind of determination, and it frustrated him, but he never seemed to take it out on his players. He was willing to take a lot of the blame for some of the unsuccessful teams that they had, and I'm sure it bothered him to hear and read some of the complaints and criticism about him. But he never tried to defer that or put that off on anybody else. So, as a player, great player, certainly a great teammate, did a lot of things out there. And then when he went into coaching, I think you talked to Harvey Grant, you talked to Darrell Walker, you know, Bernard King. I think they all would, to a man, say that they loved playing for him. He was a player's coach, and you know, just very supportive guy. But you're right, he didn't do a lot of, you know, he didn't give you a lot of quotes that would be, you know, on the 6 p.m. news or anything. But he was a straightforward guy that, you know, spoke from the heart.
Phil Chenier, the perfect voice to have on today discussing Wes Unseld. And I know it won't be an easy day for you and so many close to the family, but please let them know that D.C. is thinking about him today. And, Phil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. And I hope everybody does keep his family in prayer and thoughts. He was a great leader and great friend. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, there's Phil Chenier on Grant and Danny. We can open up the platform and open up the calls. I'd be curious, and it's probably mostly going to have to be our older listeners maybe carrying the weight here, but if you've got any stories, interactions you had with Wes and or memories of watching him play, 800-636-1067. We want to hear from you next. 800-636-1067 on G&D. Welcome back. Grant and Danny on 106.7 The Fan. Hopefully you just heard Phil Chenier on the show. talking about his good friend and his teammate, Wes Unseld, who died at 74 years old, his family releasing a statement today. Unseld, a Hall of Famer, a five-time All-Star, a former rebounding champion. In fact, he was the MVP and the Rookie of the Year. I didn't realize what Phil just told us, which is only Wilt Chamberlain did that other than Wes Unseld ever, the two guys that have ever pulled that off. But he is considered, I think, based as much on his successful playing career when he was a champion, becoming a coach, becoming an executive, a GM and a team president, playing his entire career, working his entire basketball career in this organization, you know, maybe the closest thing you'd have to like Mr. Wizard, Mr. Bullet, if you will. And so we're remembering his life with some of your calls. 800-636-1067. I've already said my first memories of him are as a GM. I mean, so I just knew that I went to the arena and I'd heard so many stories on the broadcast and seen him, obviously, on television, press conferences or otherwise, and I'd read about him. But I went to the game and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world that Wes Unseld walked by. And it was crazy to me to look up, and Phil just kind of brought this up. He wasn't that big. Like, I think of him as being 7 foot tall and like 360 pounds. I don't know why, but I remember, and I know I was a kid, but I remember thinking he was like the biggest man ever.
Right.
He's 6'7", 245. I mean, in today's NBA, like he would be dwarfed.
That's a two guard.
By, right, everybody. But we think of him because he played so physically. I mean, he was violent at setting picks, and he was feared. He was just a brick wall. His nickname on Basketball Reference is the Wide U. You know, he just had one of those bodies that he's synonymous with. But I remember him as a GM, and your first memories are of as a coach.
That's right. So he took over in the middle of the season in 87-88 for a Bullets team that probably should have been better than they were, honestly, when you had, you know, Muggsy Bogues and Bernard King and Moses Malone and Jeff Malone. These are pretty good players. Now, the East was a juggernaut in that stage. Celtics, obviously, one of the best teams ever. The Pistons would go on to be great. The Jordan's Bulls were on the rise. The Hawks, a team that nobody remembers because, you know, nobody remembers them, but they were terrific, a 50-win group as well. But he took over, and they started winning. They were 30-20-something, I think, after he took over, so there was legitimate optimism for the Bullets at that point, right, with a pretty good roster, this sort of new breath of life of a head coach. And that's one of the years that I remember. I remember going to games at Capital One Arena, and again, to me as a kid, that he was a mountain. 6'7". I mean, it was like seeing John Thompson, Big John, in person for the first time. You can't get over how big that guy is, right? And he's out there looking eyeball to eyeball with all of his players. Now, Moses Malone was a different story. I mean, he was that much bigger than everybody else. But yeah, and just sort of the legend of Wes Unseld, the reality that here he was, you know, coaching his hometown team, so to speak, because now he's a D.C. guy through and through. I loved that story. I loved that idea. And it's part of what helped me fall in love with the game and the NBA and everything like it. Those are some of my fondest memories going to, you know, the Capitol Center years ago and seeing, you know, the Bullets eke out a win or two here and there, running a million baseline screens for Jeff Malone and Moses Malone grabbing every rebound and Muggsy Bogues a foot and a half shorter than everybody else. It was a lot of fun. And yeah, so that's kind of where I was introduced. And, you know, my dad would basically tell me stories during timeouts of, well, this is what he would do. He would grab that rebound and there'd already be two guys sprinting up the court. And he would do that overhead soccer throw-in pass that nobody's really done as well since Kevin Love's kind of the 2.0 version of Wes Unseld at that. And the break would start, and there they would go. He'd barely get across half court before they got a bucket. Then he'd get back, and I mean, he would set violent screens and was just tough as nails. And I loved him. I loved Wes Unseld because of those stories.
All right, let's go to the phones and talk to and touch some of the people who either saw him play or have some thoughts on Wes Unseld. Let's go to Kevin in Arlington on line one on G&D. Kev, how are you, pal?
Hey, guys, doing great. Yeah, I was crestfallen when I learned that Wes passed. I knew he'd been in poor health, but it's one of your early heroes, and they pass away. It just sort of brings you face-to-face with your own mortality. But on a lighter note, when I first started following the Bullets, this team became the first Washington championship team of my lifetime. I was in my teens. And Wes got that team to the NBA Finals four of his first nine seasons. I think that's an important thing to note as well. I mean, they went to the Finals four out of 9 years. They were...
Yeah, I sleep on that. I forget that element of how great they were. I think of 78 in the championship. But you're right. They were knocking on the door. They had like a Caps-like run for years and years.
Well, it's very interesting. Like the Caps, like the Nats, you knew this was a championship-caliber team, but they couldn't get over the top until they finally did. I think what happened there was we acquired Bobby Dandridge, who is criminally forgotten in NBA annals, and this guy was the most clutch small forward and got us over the top. But back to Wes, and what Danny just said, there are two things when you watched him that were just amazing, and I don't think I've ever seen since. Danny just referenced the outlet passing. Danny, it was like watching Sonny Jurgensen go deep to Bobby Mitchell or Charlie Taylor. You had Kevin Porter, who was a speedster flying. He just had a knack for knowing when West would be in position to get the rebound. And it was like watching long bombs. It was really something to behold. And what made it even more entertaining was Porter had this sort of shuffle he would do and would finish with the flourish. It was just really an amazing thing. I think West is the greatest outlet passer I have ever seen. Kevin Love is a good comp, Danny. He's very similar in that way. But the other thing, and this is the thing that blew me away about West, he was the only guy who could get Jabbar off of his game. I mean, he used leverage. He used his hips, his lower body strength. As you mentioned, I mean, he was several inches shorter than Jabbar, but he had this ability to box him out, use his size, and make Jabbar uncomfortable. And I don't know that anyone ever really made Jabbar uncomfortable with that almost automatic sky hook of his. So Wes was a very unusual and very great player for the Bullets. And he was the heart and soul of that team. He was the captain, and we'll miss him forever.
It's a good phone call. Thank you. Hopefully you got to hear Shanier give you a little bit of behind the scenes on that outlet passing and the thought process of the players as they would try to get down the court knowing he had the basketball. Let's go to line two. Steve's in Silver Spring with us on Grant and Danny. Hey, Steve, how are you?
Hey, guys. Love the show.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you so much for paying tribute to Wes. You know, I'm 50 years old. I first fell in love with the NBA going out to the Capitol Center. I remember I was 10 years old. I'll never forget like it was this morning. And my dad took me out to the Capitol Center to see the San Antonio Spurs with Billy Paulson, George Gervin, and those guys. Gervin dropped 44 on him that night. And Wes was playing. It was Bobby Dandridge, Kevin Greavy, Larry Wright, Henderson. I'll never forget that team. And that's where I actually fell in love with the NBA at. And so I remember when I was 13, Wes had just retired. And he came to my junior high school, and all the kids were surrounding him. The last caller was absolutely right. Back then, 6'7" guys were mountains. You see 6'7" guys walking around the streets nowadays. But 6'7" at 13 years old, and he came to my junior high school.
A giant.
He was a mountain. Yeah, he was a giant. And, again, that's why – but he was a very nice man. I'd never forget it. Even back then when I was 13 – he treated all the kids. All the kids was running up to him. He was just a great guy. You know, he was talking to all of us. He was shaking all our hands. You know, there were no cell phones and all that back then and there. But he was signing autographs. He was just telling us to do the right thing, stay in school, you know, the blah, blah, blah. But, you know, again, he was a great guy. I would love to see what some of those guys are doing now. And if you guys can track some of those, because I listen to your show every day. So you guys could track some of those guys down, Bob Dandridge.
Yeah, that's a cool
Kevin
idea. We don't. I mean, it's not like we got a lot going on right now.
It's a good call,
sports-wise.
Yeah, I would just love to see what some of those guys are doing these days. I know Greavy owns a spot out there in Fairfax, I think called Greavy's.
Yeah, I don't think it's open anymore.
He had a restaurant just closed for years and years.
But I think, and thanks for the call. I think a couple years ago, maybe. It was no more. But I've been there. I met him there. He was a cool dude, no doubt. It's a great story, though, of going to your first game and getting to see that matchup and
awesome.
Seeing 44 dropped. But, yeah, I think when he talks about that 6'7", I can relate. Because when I was 10 when I met him, and I still think of him as being like 8 feet tall. When you're a kid, there's just no computing or relating to that. But he was like a gentle giant. Because he always had this, when they showed him on TV, he always had this scowl on his face. You know the face I'm talking about?
Yeah,
of course. He always had that same look. And because of the way he was viewed as a player in terms of being this physical mover of people, I mean, this guy was setting picks and knocking people to the ground, there was an intimidation factor there. And I remember being nervous, you know, just talking to the guy for a couple of minutes. But he couldn't have been more pleasant. 800-636-1067 is the number. Couple great stories. Let's take some more if you got them. We got nothing to do until 12:45 in Movie Club, so we'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on Wes Unseld here on Grant and Danny. Grant and Danny, in case you're curious, khaki shorts, a very tight, almost like spandexy, long-sleeved, breathable, gray undershirt. No overshirt, though.
Wow.
I wouldn't want to walk out in public wearing this thing. It is tight, my friend. It is tight.
Why is it so tight?
And that's it. No socks, no shoes. We're going barefoot today in the leather recliner in the basement. What are we working with over there, Danny?
It's just shorts and an Under Armour t-shirt. But I want to go back to this skin-tight look that you're doing. Is it constricting at all? Like, do you feel comfortable in it? Or is it moving with you? Is it sleek?
No. Yeah, it moves with me. It's sleek. Yeah. There's no extra space is all. I think it's used because it's got, like, breathable arms under the armpit. I think if you work out, you would wear this. And if you're in shape, it looks good on you. For me, it's just tight. But I think I would wear it, like, under a t-shirt if I was working out or something like that. I don't really know the point of it. I don't know how I got it. I certainly didn't buy it. But it's mine. I found it in my room today.
Yeah.
So I'm wearing it. But, yeah, that's what we're working with. Give you a live Grant and Danny on this Tuesday, June 2nd. We're taking calls on the career of Wes Unseld. He passed away at 74 years old today. Movie Club coming up at 12:45. Alan is in Lorton, wants to share some thoughts on Wes with us. Alan, thank you for the call, sir. How are you?
Okay, guys. How you guys doing?
Good, buddy.
Great, thank you.
Hey, look, I want to tell, I'm 74, so I saw a lot of Bullets games. I really got excited when Earl Monroe first came to the team. But two things about Big Wes and those outlet passes, it is absolutely true. Flick of the wrist all the way down the court. But I saw him, the thing, I remember him, he told this story where he went up to, as the rookie, to block Wilt Chamberlain's shot. And Chamberlain dunked on him and took the tip of his finger off. Now, as big and strong as Wes Unseld was, can you imagine somebody even stronger like Wilt Chamberlain taking his finger, tip of his finger off? That's what Big Wes said. But I really saw a demonstration of his strength when Wes was a coach, coaching the Bullets. And Bill Laimbeer had got into a skirmish in the middle of the court with somebody. Wes got up off the bench, walked over, scooped Bill Laimbeer up like a big industrial shovel, and lifted him up and tossed him to the side like a piece of paper. Bill Laimbeer whirled around like, what the hell is going on? Went back to that scrum and saw that it was Wes Unseld. Did not move a muscle.
Was that the exhibition game?
But I just wanted to share that.
That's a great story. I could be totally wrong about this, GP, but I think that was like a preseason game or an exhibition game or something that didn't necessarily matter. Oh, I can't remember it specifically, but I feel like Greg Jones was involved. It's hard for me to pull it exactly, but I sort of vaguely remember that incident as a kid, and it led to my hatred of those Detroit Pistons teams.
Well, the fact that it makes it Laimbeer makes it so much better for me.
Of course.
Because what I know of Laimbeer as a player, I don't know the guy at all, but as a player, I can't stand anything about him, and The Last Dance just made me hate those Pistons teams all that much more. But anything that would have involved, you know, the previous group or anybody with those Pistons teams and that mindset, for him to have done that would have been perfect. Let's go to Mike in Falls Church, line 4 on G&D. Talking about Wes Unseld, Mike.
Hey guys, how are you? How are you doing?
What's up,
Mike? I'm good. How are you? So I want to be as respectful as possible as I say this because obviously he's passed away. I actually have some for me as a Wizards fan, I had the painful memory of when he traded away Chris Webber. I had never gone to a Wizards game after that. To me, I know that he was a legend as a player, but I feel that his decisions in a present capacity really decimated the team. Now, I'm in my early 40s, and my memory of the last 30 years has been mediocrity. And for me, Chris Webber, the only time you trade a superstar is if you get something better or the superstar really wants out. And Chris Webber flourished on the Kings, and I really felt that he, by trading a young guy, a young big guy in his 20s, for an older guy, Mitch Richmond, in his 30s, a smaller guard, I really felt he decimated the team, and I always felt bitter over that.
Appreciate the call. I don't think that's something you're not allowed to say. I mean, first of all, we know that the trade ended up being a really bad trade. I think that's not making any bones about it. And, yeah, I told you, my first memories of Wes Unseld were as a GM. He didn't have a very good run as a GM. I mean, I don't think that changes anything about the man he was or what he meant to Washington basketball as a player or as a coach or an executive. I mean, he still had those posts and had those roles. But, yeah, to sit here and it would be, I think, insincere to act like he had an excellent stint as an executive. I believe they made the playoffs once from what I read today. And they were worse off probably after that than before. Now, as you said, you want to be respectful, and I don't know that today is the day to go through all of the trades he made that are bad and talk about those. But I think that phone call is very much reasonable.
I don't think that's out of bounds. Yeah,
I
think it's out of bounds.
I agree. I just pulled up a story, by the way, from May of 98, written by Joe White, the late Joe White, who was a very good buddy of mine in the media, who I still can't believe even saying it out loud. You almost feel like, he's not gone. No, he is, which is sad. But anyway, this trade wasn't about talent. It was about leadership, maturity, and image. It was about a series of troubling moments that capture Chris Webber's season. One arrest, one grand jury investigation, one slit across his throat to show off after a victory, the no-shows at major team functions, and 82 games of leaderless basketball. That was his lead. Now, his quote here from Wes Unseld, the GM at the time, whether we got older wasn't as much a factor as whether we got a little bit more mature on the court. Those of you who know Mitch Richmond, you can feel comfortable in what he can bring to you on the court, the stability and maturity that a young team like this needs. So they traded Webber, who would go on to become one of the biggest stars in the NBA, for
great
Mitch Richmond and Otis Thorpe, a couple of veterans with reputations. And Wes Unseld did the kind of thing that I probably would screw up doing a bunch of times, which is I want pros. I want winners. I'm Mike Singletary, right? But I want guys who act like adults. And I need, you know, malcontents who don't get it, who are immature, who are about themselves. I wouldn't have a lot of them. This one happened to backfire because Webber did mature and did become that dude in Sacramento.
Yeah, this was, again, I think it's fair to say, a legend, a star, magnanimous person, a great guy who did, the balance sheet is way more to the good than the bad. I don't think he was a terribly good executive. I think that's perfectly fine to say. You could point to the Chris Webber trade. You could certainly the Ben Wallace trade for Ike Austin. It blew up in their face and didn't work particularly well, as Ben Wallace and another one of his picks, Richard Hamilton, would go on to win a title in Detroit, basically as cast-offs of former Bullets / Wizards. So, yeah, I mean, they weren't very good and hadn't been very good pretty much my entire life. But I still think that's perfectly okay to mention that today. It doesn't take away from his legacy, ultimately, for me. Again, that would be on the, hey, was he a good general manager? Probably not. I don't know if he was the greatest coach ever either. But, man, oh, man, what a larger-than-life figure. And I don't think anything is diminished by those bits of information to point out.
We watched a scary classic last night. We'll talk about it on Movie Club and pick a new film next on The Fan. You know this by now. Every day at 12:45, without sports, to give ourselves something to do, we have a little Movie Club segment where we assign a film to watch that night. We watch it, we get back and compare notes. We pick a movie for the next day. Last night we watched Cape Fear, a 1991 crime thriller of a classic, 2-hour and 8-minute flick. I had seen more of this movie than I thought. I told you yesterday I hadn't seen it, and as I watched it, you know, you pick up scenes and you're like, oh, I remember this, I remember this. It's been a really long time, though, and the end of this movie is just so freaky. It is scary. It's
Yeah.
It's really well done. Like, I think it's a great movie. I really do. I'm not a big fan. I wouldn't call this horror. It's more suspense.
Suspense, thriller, yeah.
Yeah, of this genre in general, I would rather watch, like, cheap action or comedy or something like that. But De Niro as Max Cady is outstanding. Nick Nolte as Sam Bowden is perfect. Jessica Lange, his wife, at that time it was gorgeous, is really, really good. The daughter who played their 15-year-old high school age daughter was Juliette Lewis, who was in the middle of her breakout in her career. At that time, she was 18 years old, kind of peaking at this point as an actress, I think, in terms of all the projects. I'm trying to remember the movies that I remember her from, but she rattled off like 7 or 8 movies as a teenager in a row at that time. But the dialogue, the writing in this movie is just really, really sharp. So I'll start by saying this. I think this was the perfect note struck for suspense, where there's enough of it, of kind of like weirdness without it being scary, that you're like, what's going to happen? And the whole time you're wondering what are we building up to, more so than you're sitting there with a tense stomach in fear. And I liked that about this movie. The last 30 minutes become obviously very scary. But, man, I don't know how De Niro didn't win an Academy Award as Max Cady. I know he got nominated for a Golden Globe and an Oscar, but he was awesome. This is a slam dunk from him. I really liked it. I'll give it a solid 7.5 or 8 out of 10 for me.
Criminally underrated movie, in my opinion. And I think you touched on a lot of the right elements. Nolte is great as kind of this, you know, morally ambiguous, you know, do I do my duty? I'm concerned about my family, sort of self-preservation, kind of selfish guy that you don't necessarily love the entire movie, but you obviously don't necessarily think he deserves to die or that his family deserves to get tormented in this way. And De Niro is just amazing in this movie, right? What a departure. I mean, think about what do you think of when you think of Robert De Niro, right? Playing gangsters. I mean, he was incredible in Raging Bull, sort of bulked up for that and had a different role. This is a completely different thing for De Niro to do, and he's unbelievable in this role. He's just great. And you touched on Juliette Lewis, who, you know, this was the height of her career, right? As sort of a late teenager, early 20s, where she was just in stuff and was great at it. Everything from California to this, to Cape Fear, to, you know, Christmas Vacation and a million other things. And she was so good. Scorsese doesn't get enough credit for this one. His masterpieces, we know them, whether it's Departed, Wolf of Wall Street, Goodfellas, etc. This one kind of gets lost in the shuffle. I think it's a great movie. And it, you're right, it strikes kind of the right tone of, it's not jump scares, it's not fear all the time, but it you know, you see the relentlessness of this psychotic, determined, singularly focused person in Max Cady, and you feel like the helplessness as all the different things happen, where the system is sort of failing Nick Nolte, the system that he's a part of, that he would sort of count on, right? He's going, wait a minute, how do I have a restraining order? This guy's, you know, the family dog is dead. I'm my private investigator. He beat up the guys that I sent to beat him up. And it's all just sort of crumbling around him. It's really, really well done. 8.5 carbohydrates out of 10 for your pal Rainey Duya.
Ooh. All right.
8.5.
So you're even going higher than I did. Yeah, it sounds like it was a slam dunk all across the board for the movie club. All right, Tommy and Dar want to get straight to picking the movie in the interest of time, so let's do that. I have 10 films here. They are all streaming on Netflix. 10 of the first movies I saw that looked interesting. Most of them are either comedies or considered in the blockbuster category. So why don't we start with Thom to weed through these films. Thommy, the first movie for you, Lincoln Lawyer, Matt McConaughey.
Yes.
Heartbreak Kid, this is Ben Stiller.
It's been on the list before, and I'm going to say no.
All right, it has been here before. We have been here before. The Other Guys.
Yes.
Hitch.
Sure, because I know you like that movie.
Jerry Maguire.
Yes.
The Family. This is also De Niro. This is a little change of pace.
Okay.
Guess Who.
No.
Good choice. The Patriot.
Yes.
Olympus Has Fallen.
Yes.
Patriot Games.
Yes.
Ooh, we didn't knock a whole lot off here. All right, Dari, you're up. You ready?
Yes.
I'm going to go in reverse order. Patriot Games.
No.
Olympus Has Fallen.
No.
Surprising. The Patriot.
No. It's a little too long for tonight.
The Family.
I don't know what that is, so no.
De Niro. All right. Well, we're not having any problem not eliminating things this time.
I see what's happening here, by the way. Yeah. I'm on to you, Dar.
Jerry Maguire.
No.
All right. Danny still has too much
power.
Go.
He has too much power. I know what he's doing.
All right, we're skipping Dar now. There's three movies left. Are you ready, Danny?
Yes.
I see what Dar was doing.
I see what he's doing.
Lincoln Lawyer.
I'll say yes to that.
The Other Guys.
No to that, Dar. No to The Other Guys.
Joke's on you. I want Lincoln Lawyer.
Oh, I'm sure you do. I'm sure that's what you're looking for, man.
And the last movie is Hitch.
Nope.
All right. We're watching Lincoln Lawyer tonight.
Well done, Danny.
All right. All right.
That is the movie. I don't know if that's what Dar was planning on, but that
it was a win-win.
That is where we ended up. Final hour of G&D on a day in which we'll be watching Lincoln Lawyer come nighttime. You're listening to The Fan.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.